The jobs numbers came in unexpectedly low, but is that really a bad thing? We talk Mexico tariffs and the changing face of presidential campaign staffs. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdal. It's Friday, June 7th. Good to have you with us. And it's Jobs Report Day. 75,000. That's the number of jobs added to the economy in May, according to the Labor Department. It's around 100,000 jobs below what most economists expected. On the other hand, the unemployment rate was unchanged, still at the almost 50-year low of 3.6%. Plus, there were jobs available for the 176,000 people who entered the workforce in May, which is pretty good. So, glass half empty, half full. Depends on how you look at it. Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
There's plenty of evidence in this report for the glass half empty. Let's start with the slowdown in job creation, from manufacturing to the service sector.
Payroll gains have averaged 164,000 a month thus far this year, compared to 223,000 per month last year.
Chris Varvaris at IHS Market says May's number isn't just a one-month bad jobs report blip, but reflects a slowdown in growth across the U.S. economy. Tendai Kipfidze at LendingTree chalks that up to the fading of fiscal stimulus from last year's tax cuts, and also tariff battles with China, Europe, Mexico.
The trade negotiations do reduce confidence in the economy and businesses pull back.
Most worrying to Kipfidze is the slowdown in annual wage growth.
The slowest in 9 months, it was 3.1%. Wage growth well above inflation, you know, would give a more positive outlook for the economy later in the year.
But even with job creation and wage growth slowing down, the situation is far from a disaster, says Ryan Nunn at the Hamilton Project.
The unemployment rate remains quite low relative to where it's been over the last 12 months or so.
An indication, Nunn says, that a recession isn't coming anytime soon. Chris Varvaris at IHS says the hiring downturn we've seen may not be so bad either.
Part of the reason for the slowing in employment gains is the increasing difficulty that employers have finding qualified workers in such a tight labor market.
Now, keep in mind, to keep up with all the new people entering the job market, employers only need to add around 80 to 100,000 jobs every month, which is pretty close to what we got in May. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
For more on those jobs numbers and other big economic news of the week, I'm joined now live by Dion Rabowan of Axios and Gina Smilek of The New York Times. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kimberly.
Hey, what's going on, Kimberly?
So, Gina, let's start with you and get your take on what Mitchell just laid out. Good numbers or bad numbers?
You know, I would say that I think on balance, you have to take this as a bad number report. And I think the reason is, as he highlighted, that wage number, 3.1%, marked the third straight deceleration in wage gains. And I think that that makes the weak job number look a lot worse, because if you thought job gains were slowing because the labor market's tight, you would expect wages to be moving up. If you thought jobs were slowing because the economy overall is weakening, this is what you would have seen.
Dion, what do you think?
Oh, man, you know what? Gina made a real strong, solid case there for this being a glass half empty kind of situation. I look at it the other way, though. I feel like everyone's really overreacting to this, and we're once again kind of letting the president and the overall atmosphere in Washington shift the narrative. If I told you, I don't know, a year ago, 2 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, that we were averaging 165,000 jobs for the year, that we had just had, and this is again coming off a report, we had 263,000 jobs back in April. Wage gains are still higher than they've been over the past 10 years, over that 10-year period average. So overall, when you look at this number, I mean, it's not great. It's not blow the bank out. And when you look at it from the fact that we spent $1.5 trillion to get here, yeah, it's not great. But just in terms of how this looks for the overall economy, it's not half bad.
And so you're talking about the president setting the narrative. So let's switch back here to Washington to trade and the real possibility that come Monday, there's going to be a new 5% tariff/tax on imports from Mexico. Gina, how did the markets take this week?
Yeah. So interestingly, I think markets are actually rallying into the end of the week. At least the stock market is, on the expectation that the Fed is going to have to cut rates because of all of this uncertainty that's going on in the economy right now, which is partly because of these trade negotiations and the tariffs that are coming down the line. You know, we saw Jay Powell, the Fed chair, give a real solid signal that the Fed stands ready to act if the economy slows. We also saw some signs that the economy might be slowing. So if you do that arithmetic, I think that's a pretty positive story for stocks.
And Dan, what did you think about what Fed Chair Powell had to say this week about this?
Yeah, Fed Chair Powell came out. He said, I got the bazooka. I got the machine gun. Like, anything y'all need, we ready. JPZ in the house. I'm ready to do what it do. This really, and again, what was really interesting about the speech from Chicago that you talk about was he started it off with this, we're ready to act as needed to maintain the economy or maintain the recovery, whatever it was. He really made very clear to markets that have been pricing in for months now, going on most of this year, at least one cut. We're now pricing in at least three cuts of the Fed rate, of Fed funds rate. And some people are now starting to think that there could be as much as 50 basis points cut in July, maybe even a cut this month in June. All these things are really being pulled forward in terms of expectations for the market. What's insane about this is right now where Fed funds are, it's really just a little bit above inflation. The economy should be able to exist, and a healthy economy should be able to persist and grow with interest rates at 1 or 2% above the rate of inflation. We're basically right at the rate of inflation right now, and we can't even do with that. So that's really a thing to be worried about, if you must worry.
And Gina, you kind of alluded to this earlier. This kind of gives the president exactly what he wants, right? He's been pushing the Fed to cut interest rates, and his trade war with basically everybody seems likely to force Powell to do so.
So I think this is one of the reasons it would be really unlikely for us to see a June cut. And you are seeing, as Dion mentioned, you are seeing some people expect that. But if they cut rates in June, it's going to send stocks on a sugar high. It's going to sort of be permissive of further escalation in these trade tensions. Trump and Xi may have a meeting at the G20, which is at the end of June. And so I think it makes a lot of sense from the Fed's perspective to maybe wait until July and then get on that train.
This push and pull is happening with all these signals we're getting, slowing global growth, the jobs numbers we got today, that manufacturing slowdown Mitchell mentioned. Dion, I'll end with you very quickly. Is there really a lot that the Fed can do here to kind of manage all of this at once?
That's a great question, and it really gets to the heart of the matter. As I talked about, interest rates are still historically low, and you've got the Fed talking about easing rates, you've got the ECB, the BOJ, basically global central banks around the world going back into stimulus mode. And stimulus mode hasn't worked out so well. Europe is on the brink of recession. Japan is on the brink of recession. China's really slowing. And they just keep throwing more money at the problem. It doesn't seem to be working.
Dion Rabone of Axios and Gina Smilek of the New York Times. Thanks, you two.
Thank you.
Killed that intro, Kimberly.
Thanks. How did the markets like the trade news and those jobs numbers? We'll have those details when we do the numbers. It's been one of the rainiest springs on record in the Farm Belt. Many fields in the Midwest that would usually be full of growing corn, soybeans, and wheat instead look like swamps. These are no conditions for planting. The USDA says farmers are way behind, and growers are in a race against the seasonal clock to get seeds in the ground. Some farmers are risking their expensive equipment in muddy fields and then posting images on social media of those machines stuck in the mud or being towed out of it. Marketplace's Renato Sego has more from the farmers about what they're up against.
This planting season is the worst Kenny Ranky's ever seen. And he's been growing soybeans and corn on his farm in Neely, Nebraska for almost 20 years. His land was still frozen in March when he'd normally be fertilizing his soil. And today, he's got small lakes across his land.
It's too much water and too wet. We can't get equipment across it.
Ranky is 3 weeks behind getting seeds into the ground. On his farm in northeast Texas, Alexander Frick is still trying to plant his corn and soybeans. He's usually done by late April, but he hasn't gone 5 days in a row this spring without rain.
You plant something and then it gets flooded again, so you may have to go back and replant it.
He's got 400 acres of land that's basically a swamp. What he managed to get planted is submerged.
So you just basically have to live with less income this year.
Mitchell Hora farms in Iowa and runs an ag consulting business on the side. He's telling farmers to get as much seed in the ground as possible, even if they won't be able to sell their crops on the usual markets.
Try to harvest some of that, you know, as much as we can and utilize it for cover crop seed or feed it. It's great feed for hogs or for poultry, you know.
Nebraska farmer Kenny Ranke says this past few growing seasons have been a little cold and wet. And now with this year's flooding.
I hope it's not the new normal.
Even without this historically wet spring, times have been tough for farmers. Lately, normal has meant lower crop prices, falling income, and disappearing markets because of the trade war. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
So since we just talked about mud, let's make a little turn and talk about laundry, specifically dry cleaning. What if dry cleaning weren't really dry anymore? Some cleaners are heading in that direction as state and local policies push them away from chemicals used in traditional dry cleaning. They're moving instead to professional wet cleaning technology. In Seattle, Eilish O'Neill reports on a program encouraging dry cleaners to make the switch.
At Sun Cleaners in North Seattle, Hyun-Soop Kang and her husband Tae Park are busy pressing clean shirts, arranging them in machines that stretch and steam them to get rid of all the wrinkles. Kang and Park have owned this dry cleaning business since 1985. Kang says she first started to worry about the chemicals they were using when a woman at her church, who also owned a dry cleaner for decades, got sick. Kang learned the woman had stomach cancer.
At the hospital, they told her to quit dry cleaning. They said, don't do dry cleaning anymore. It's bad for your health. That is very scary.
At the same time, Kang was having her own health problems. She blames them on the chemical she and her husband used to clean clothes, perchloroethylene, or PERC for short.
The PERC hurt my chest and made me dizzy. It's horrible.
The EPA says PERC can cause headaches and dizziness. National Institutes of Health studies have found that people who work in dry cleaning stores that use perchloroethylene are at increased risk for some cancers and for kidney disease. A trade group representing perchloroethylene manufacturers disputes those findings, saying that evidence of cancer in humans is limited at best and often confounded by exposure to other possible carcinogens. State environmental regulators are also concerned about environmental effects. When perchloroethylene is spilled, it can leak through unsealed concrete and eventually into groundwater. The trade group says the risk of leaks is minimal because the newest dry cleaning machines only require a small amount of PERC and are sealed to prevent leaking. But Steve Whitaker, a toxicologist with King County Public Health in Washington, says wet cleaning is the best alternative.
The chemicals that are used along with the water in the professional wet cleaning process are a lot safer than the chemicals that are traditionally used with PERC dry cleaning.
So King County is offering $20,000 grants for dry cleaners to switch away from dry cleaning to professional wet cleaning technology. Basically, extremely precise detergents in laundry machines, which can be programmed to protect, say, suits and wedding dresses. Switching from dry cleaning to wet cleaning can cost anywhere from $40,000 to $60,000. One reason many dry cleaners might want to buy new machines is that it's possible they'll have to stop using PERC soon. The EPA has already ruled that dry cleaners in residential buildings have to stop using PERC machines by the end of 2020. And the agency could expand that ban, says Ashley Peterson, a policy liaison at Seattle's local hazardous waste management program.
So a big part of this program was so we could help our local dry cleaners.
Peterson says the reason the county is offering grants instead of handing down a ban is to make sure dry cleaners both stay in business and switch to the safest alternative to perchloroethylene. Back at Sun Cleaners, Kang says since she and Park took the grant to get the wet cleaning machine, she feels better.
I'm rich, Danny.
I don't get tired, not at all, after switching to this new machine.
Other places are also trying to transition away from perchloroethylene. California has passed a complete ban on PERC, which comes into force in 2023, and several other states have offered financial or technical assistance to dry cleaners to help them stop using PERC. In Seattle, I'm Alicia O'Neill for Marketplace.
Coming up,
where are we? What is this world? What are we wanting the audience to think when they walk in the space?
Translating the world you see in your head to what an audience sees on the screen. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average climbing again today, 263 points, 1%, to close at 25,983. The NASDAQ boosted 126 points, 1.75%, to finish at 7,742. And the S&P 500 was up 29 points, 1%, to end at 2,873. For the week, the Dow rose 4.7%, the NASDAQ gained 3.9%, and the S&P climbed 4.4%. FedEx says it's ending its domestic air shipping contract with Amazon, which has been developing its own delivery system. FedEx delivered nearly 0.75%. Amazon picked up 2.8%. Meat substitute company Beyond Meat exceeded analyst expectations with its first quarterly report after going public. Beyond Meat served up more than 39%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.08%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Not everyone gets a chance to study the economy in school. Anyway, who doesn't need a brush up? Marketplace helps you continue your education in a way that we hope is smart, accessible, and hopefully even a bit fun. Your donation is not only an investment in your own learning, but also in helping us make more people smart about the economy. And that, we think, is good for everyone. To learn how you can help, visit marketplace.org/investors. Thank you.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams, in for Kai Ryssdal. The race to become president is well underway, and as more candidates compete for the Democratic Party's nomination, there are more job openings for campaign staff. And this year's group of strategists, PR folks, and campaign managers is different from previous election cycles. It's more diverse, with more women and people of color than ever before. For more on what's behind the change, I'm joined by Jennifer Lawless, Commonwealth Professor of Politics at the University of Virginia. Jennifer, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So how do the presidential campaigns of today look different than campaigns of the past?
The biggest difference is gender. Until this election cycle, we certainly have been far from legitimate gender diversity when it comes to the people occupying the top tier of congressional campaign roles. And this cycle, among the Democrats, there are many, many women working not only as campaign managers, but also as high-level operatives. And that represents a fundamental change from the past.
Can you tell me a little bit more about what drove that increased number of women into the pipeline?
I think it's a few different factors. The first is that it's a matter of simple patience. The women that have been working in presidential politics for the last 10 or 12 years now have the kind of experience to make them well-positioned to get these top jobs. But part of it is certainly enthusiasm and energy on the Democratic side of the aisle surrounding the importance of diversity. And so in the 2018 midterms, we saw more female candidates run than we'd ever seen before. It's not a surprise that we're also seeing more women step up to run the campaigns among the Democrats as well.
You mentioned that the biggest change in diversity that we're seeing is in regards to gender. What else are you seeing?
There's racial diversity, there's gender diversity, there's also increased diversity in terms of the different kinds of backgrounds and credentials that campaign managers have. And something that I would note here is that the Democrats have 24 people running for president. That creates a lot of opportunities for people that might not typically look the part or seem the part to play a really important role in presidential politics.
What trends are you seeing in regards to racial diversity in the Democratic presidential campaigns?
We're seeing an uptick in terms of high-level professionals working in presidential politics among the Democrats as well. Something that I would note that makes racial diversity a little bit different than gender diversity is that women aren't monolithically Democratic. So when it comes to racial diversity, almost every African-American, almost every Latino in elected office today is a Democrat. And so when you have a lot of Democratic candidates run, that really opens the door for a lot of African-American and Latino voters to get enthusiastic and also for operatives to get jobs.
So given that we are seeing more women and people of color on the campaign staffs of the Democratic candidates, what has it changed in regards to how they're running their campaigns or the policy proposals they're putting out?
It's too early to tell. We're focused on these campaigns and we're focused on the nuances of policies. But at this point, we actually, with the exception of a few candidates, don't know much about those kinds of nuances. The first debates will be a good opportunity for the candidates to begin to flesh out some detailed plans. But at this point, I think it's sending a signal to the voters and to the Democratic Party more broadly that they're walking the walk. They're not just saying that they want to make sure that they represent all Americans. They're actually making sure that their campaigns symbolically represent all Americans as well. As far as policy differences and rhetorical differences, I think that will become a lot more obvious over the course of the next few months.
Jennifer Lawless is Commonwealth Professor of Politics at the University of Virginia. Thank you.
Thank you.
Broadway's Best will receive their honors this weekend at the 73rd Annual Tony Awards on Sunday. So today, we'll hear from someone who makes those Broadway shows come to life. Dane Laffrey designed sets and costumes for the theater, including the set for the latest revival of Christopher Shin's play, Dying City, which is playing now at the Tony Kaiser Theater in New York City. As it turns out, making theater involves a bit of economics. Here's his story.
Hey, I'm Dane Laffrey, and I'm a set and costume designer for theater. Basically, the designer is responsible for everything that you look at in the theater. So any physical object that is on stage is something that I am responsible for. The best design really does go from, like, the macro to the super granular. So you really, like, have a lot of conversations about, like, oh, is that the right coffee cup? Should we look at 10 other coffee cups? Probably. To, like, where are we? What is this world? What are we wanting the audience to think when they walk in the space? Sets are, like, other characters, you know? And what differentiates set design from, like, architecture is that we are not always dealing in the real and the concrete. We also get to deal in the fantastical, the magical, the surreal. Obviously, like, budget is, it's always a factor. I have certainly worked on shows that have, like, a $1,200 budget and shows that have a $750,000 budget. It can be a punishing limitation or it can be a helpful limitation. And having an understanding of economy in the work does have a relationship to, like, actual, you know, the economy of making theater, because you sort of know that, like, however big you're dreaming about it, like, that thing ultimately sort of has to fit into this kind of a box, not this kind of a box. I think people come into design from a lot of different places, and certainly for me, but I think it's a common thread among designers and other theater professionals, is that, like, the first love was theater. But I wasn't an actor. I discovered that quite early on. And then I eventually, like, found my way towards scenic and costume design, and that was really the, like, beginning of it for me. It's not because I love to design things, it's because I love to make theater.
This final note on the way out. So I was all excited to talk about NASA's announcement today that it would allow tourists, okay, really rich tourists, to visit the International Space Station at $35,000 a night, plus tens of millions more in other costs. It's a way for NASA to raise money to help meet the Trump administration's goal of putting humans back on the moon by 2024. And then President Trump tweeted, quote, "For all the money we are spending, NASA should not be talking about going to the moon. We did that 50 years ago. They should be focused on much bigger things we are doing, including Mars, of which the moon is a part, defense, and science." End tweet. What? We've got to go. Today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 263 points, 1%. The NASDAQ boosted 126 points, 1 2/3%. And the S&P 500 was up 29 points, 1% there. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. And I'm Kimberly Adams, in for Kai Rizdahl. Have a good weekend. Kai is back on Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.